Hello and welcome to Formative Media with me, Christian Spicer, the show that celebrates the media that inspires, influences, and defines us. You can support the show and get ad-free episodes and access to our bonus show Zeitgeist over at patreon.com/formativemediashow. Our patrons are truly the reason why this show will continue. Consider becoming one. And speaking of patrons, the patron-exclusive State of the Podcast episode just went live for patrons, where we break down what it takes to make each episode, the production realities, stats, and so much more. Again, that's available now over at patreon.com/formativemediashow. Of course, other ways to support the show include reviewing us on your podcast provider of choice and simply telling your friends about us. On today's show is writer and storyteller Dave Mongan. Dave worked for years as a writer and then executive story editor on the hit CBS procedural Without a Trace. After that, he moved into video games and worked on Bungie's excellent first-person shooter Destiny, and then worked as a senior narrative director at Xbox before heading out on his own, starting Curious Wonderland, serving as a story and narrative consultant for video games.
But, you know, it immediately makes you go, this is a different class of criminal. This is somebody who makes their own rules and breaks them. And then, you know, I think it comes to a peak when, you know, he's sitting atop that, like, huge stack of money, like, you know, 50% of the mob's, you know, cash. And he says, this was never about the money. This is about making a statement. And he lights it on fire, and you're like, oh my God, like, to your point, like, he keeps one-upping himself and going, you know, okay, I've established that, you know, I'm going to break the rules, and now I'm going to break them a different way, and now I'm going to show you that I just don't give a damn about, you know, what all the rest of the criminals in this world value most. I'm going to show you that, like, I'm here to make a statement. And I think that that's the larger point of his character in this movie. It's all about making a statement and making people sit up and notice it.
And just in case you couldn't tell from that bit of our conversation there and didn't immediately know what Dave was talking about, and I guess also didn't look at the episode title, Dave is bringing the Dark Knight to the show. Heck and yes. On any given day, The Dark Knight is likely my favorite movie of all time. So yeah, I was very excited for this one. So let's meet Dave and dig in, shall we?
Ago, these cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
So what are you proposing?
It's simple. Kill the Batman. Here's my card.
I am Dave Mongan. I am a lifelong storyteller who has transitioned from writing in TV, procedural crime dramas, into writing video games. Today, I want to talk about perhaps the greatest superhero movie ever made, The Dark Knight. Whenever I'm talking about, you know, a piece of media that has impacted me deeply as a creative, I always come back to The Dark Knight because it's just, you know, it hits on so many different levels. You know, obviously great action pieces, but also just so much fantastic psychology for the heroes and villains and supporting cast. It's a masterclass.
Let's pick at that thread a little bit. You've done certainly tons of writing, starting in TV, Without a Trace. Was that your first TV?
Yes, it was. It was after a long career of, you know, trying to work my way up in the industry. I finally got my big break on Without a Trace, and they bought a story idea from me that another writer wrote. Then they brought me in to pitch episode ideas for the following season, and loved one of those and let me write a freelance episode. And then because that went really well, they brought me back on staff for several years. And I was in the writer's room every day, breaking countless episodes for over 3 years. And it was there that I really learned the power of collaboration and how much I love collaboration and, you know, being surrounded with just talented, passionate people who, you know, are all in service of the story. And there was a big transition from that into games where, you know, I'll just go back for 1 second. There's this horrible saying in TV writing that, you know, in TV writing, the writer is God. You know, the writer creates something and then everybody rushes to make it happen. In games, it is not that way at all. In games, you know, design pretty much, you know, leads the charge, and narrative has a seat at the table, and art has a seat at the table. But if the game's not fun to play, then people aren't going to really want to stick around for the story. So I had to learn a lot about transitioning storytelling and character development skills into an interactive medium where, you know, the gameplay comes first.
Talking about a crime or a noir film like The Dark Knight, while Without a Trace is different in that it was procedural and in the days of television, where were you guys doing 22 episode orders or seasons?
24 episodes, yeah.
Just a different, for people listening that don't comprehend that, and it was every season there'd be a new season, not a 4-year gap before the next 8 episodes. Like, pedal to the metal, you guys were cranking. Okay, interrupting myself here for a quick, I don't know, micro history lesson of sorts regarding American TV seasons. In the UK and other places, seasons were often a little different, but here in the US, for decades, from like the late 60s through the mid-2010s, okay, a season of TV usually had between 20 and 26 episodes, and they would pretty much air week after week after week after week. Oh, and before the 60s, seasons of TV were even longer. Now, though, well, Prime Video's exclusive series Reacher had 8 episodes in season 3. The first season of Apple TV's exclusive series Severance, 9 episodes. The final season of Netflix's exclusive series Stranger Things, well, see, that season had 2 volumes. The first volume was 4 episodes, and the second set was 3 episodes, and then there was a finale. And season 5 also premiered, like, what, 3 years after season 4 released? I'm just saying, that's not how it used to be done. Now, you could argue quality, VFX, scope, production, budgets, etc., 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 have all changed from those old days of TV seasons past. But just from a writing perspective, TV was a different animal.
One of the really interesting things about Without a Trace was, yes, it was a crime drama, and yes, each week there was somebody who did something bad to somebody else, but it really was heavily weighted on the psychology of everybody involved. You know, so it was about, for those who don't know, Without a Trace was a procedural drama set in New York City featuring the Missing Persons Division of the NYPD. No, Missing Persons Division of the FBI. God, it's been so long. And each week, a person from New York City would go missing, and the Missing Persons Division would jump into action and go out and kind of like unravel that person's life to figure out what happened to them, where they were, and how we can save them. And it meant diving into the psychology of the missing person and figuring out, like, because you need all the necessary misleads, it was like, well, how did this person get themselves into trouble? And then that oftentimes would lead to, you know, engaging with the bad guy or the bad person. Don't want to be gendered here, but
the villain of the episode.
The villain, thank you very much. but rather than wanting to have just kind of like, you know, stock caricature villains, we wanted to understand the psychology of the villains and what it was that brought them to the point of desperation where they were willing to go and make somebody disappear. And that was our primary directive. I oftentimes will talk about how, you know, Jack Nicholson was, I think, arguably the other famous version of the Joker. I know there have been some since Heath Ledger, but, you know, Jack Nicholson kind of like put his stamp on that role, but it was a caricature.
I remember the first time I saw Batman, or Batman 89 as it's called now, in theaters. Jack Nicholson just jumped off the screen to me. He was playing a caricature for sure, but his commitment to the bit was incredible. I'd guess lines from The Dark Knight get quoted more now than lines from Batman 89, but it sure seemed like every kid on the playground back then had the "Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight?" quote, waiting and ready to go whenever for whatever. And the first time we saw his full reveal as Joker, whoa, Tim Burton was blowing my comic book reading kid mind.
Maybe we can cut a deal. Jack. Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier.
It was a larger than life character who was kind of there to say funny things and make a joke.
What a day.
Heath Ledger's version of the Joker was there to make you think and to kind of, you know, put our hero into moral quandaries, which I think, you know, the psychology behind somebody who wants to do that is fascinating. And it, in my mind, it makes it instantly more relatable to just average schmoes who are like, oh my gosh, like if I had a traumatic upbringing, yeah, I totally see how I could just want to watch the world burn and, you know, how I would turn into an agent of chaos or whatever. But it's all this effort to kind of like dig deeper and understand like the underlying psychology of who, you know, who we're talking to, who we're experiencing in a story. And that, like, I do that in video games too. Even though in video games we have so few opportunities to understand our villains, we need to make every single one of those moments matter. And it's a heck of a lot of fun.
One thing that jumped out at me, I think probably the first time I watched The Dark Knight, but certainly again when I rewatched it recently ahead of this conversation, is there something so satisfying in how Nolan gives you backstory for Heath's Joker, but also leaves it ambiguous, but not in a frustrating way. I think some people might look at other Nolan films, you know, the great debates around the ending of some Christopher Nolan films and what happens and kind of meant to be open-ended. And you can get some online heated disagreements about things. But I think the way that they handled the Joker is perhaps different than, you know, Memento or Inception, in that it is still open-ended what actually happened, how he got those scars or what his upbringing is. But the way that I think it channels into the character is such a satisfying one. And I'm curious your thoughts on that kind of background, where we're given a lot of background for the character, but as the audience, we're left wondering if any of it is true or if any of it matters.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because he is an incredibly unreliable, you know, voice.
Yeah.
And just like the way that he has different stories for how he got his scars, any one of them could be true. But the fact that these are like in his mind and that he, you know, uses those as like a prelude to committing more violence, you know, it just shows how cracked he is. And you kind of you understand and appreciate how, you know, how a scrambled mind like that, you know, becomes the hero of his own story. Because I think, like, even as he's talking about these moments of trauma, you know, there's kind of this pride that he puts out there, like, yes, Ike, my wife was cheating and I had this horrible accident and like and I cut myself, but here I am. Like, and he says it with this like bravado, or when he's talking about like defending his mom, like there's just this pride that comes through as if he envisions himself as a survivor.
You want to know how I got these scars? My father was a drinker and a fiend. And one night, he goes off crazier than usual. Mommy gets the kitchen knife to defend herself. He doesn't like that. Not one bit.
show.
And that combined with just like the horrible things that we see him doing, you kind of, you walk away going, this is a nuanced character, and I can't trust a single word coming out of his mouth, and that's what makes me understand who he is at the core.
Why so serious?
You know, he is that agent of chaos because his life and his mind and his fractured personality.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Is chaos.
And
why so serious?
But I don't know that any other actor could kind of do that and give us kind of a scattershot impression of this character, but still make like the shards still feel like they fit and are, you know, coherent. I think a lot of times, you know, actors will kind of give like little moments. They'll have like, this scene is going to express this part of my character, and this scene's going to express this part. And it kind of feels like, yeah, you know what? It's like a pastiche as opposed to, you know, a mosaic, which I think is what Ledger did. It's just, it's pretty powerful, huh?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think oftentimes you will see a character in a film, or even sometimes when you're reading a book or a comic book, where it's like the, you see different versions of a character and they don't necessarily coalesce into a whole. But at no point, for me, at least in The Dark Knight, does it seem like we're getting that from Heath Ledger's version of the Joker. There is always this kinetic whole that is always just hurling forward at breakneck speed, that all the other pieces, I think that's a great analogy as to a mosaic, what it creates, this terrifying picture of, you know, the world that we all live in. And I think to some extent how vulnerable we all are in the world, especially with the Joker's attempts to drive the world into his madness, where I think he's maybe most effective with Harvey Dent / Two-Face with the scene in the hospital. But then as he tries to get regular people to accept the chaos of the world around them too, I think is a really interesting lens in which to view that character, where it's, I'm broken, or I'm not broken, the world is broken and you're going to see it too.
Absolutely. And I think that he, by using like social experiments, essentially, he is pushing people to the point where he's like, you know, the world is broken, and given the right circumstances or the wrong circumstances, you will become just like me. And I think that that is, you know, that's like the great conflict between him and Batman. You know, Batman lives in a world of rules and is like, you know, like if we follow the rules, then, you know, things will make sense. But, you know, it immediately makes you go, this is a different class of criminal. This is somebody who makes their own rules and breaks them. And then, you know, I think it comes to a peak when, you know, he's sitting atop that like huge stack of money, like, you know, 50% of the mob's, you know, cash. And he says, this is never about the money. This is about making a statement. And he lights it on fire. And you're like, oh my God, like, to your point, like, he keeps one-upping himself and going, you know, okay, I've established that, you know, I'm going to break the rules. And now I'm going to break them a different way. And now I'm going to show you that I just don't give a damn about, you know, what all the rest of the criminals in this world value most. I'm going to show you that, like, I'm here to make a statement. And I think that that's the larger point of his character in this movie. It's all about making a statement and making people sit up and notice it.
The idea of just following the rules and things will make sense is such a fragile concept, right? It's also one we all kind of live in, but at the same time struggle against. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to terrible people? Why do the wretched and terrible get away with so much in broad daylight? Is society too far gone? Are the rules there to help us or keep us contained? Is it okay to break the rules if we're doing it to stop something really bad from happening? All stuff that Batman and the movie The Dark Knight as a whole asks the audience to struggle with, to sit and roll around with. And we'll do that here too. Let it sit for a bit as we take a short break for some sponsors. We'll be right back. With your pedigree as a writer, I'd be remiss not to ask your thoughts on
kind of the writing behind this film and this character. I think people talk about, and rightfully so, Christopher Nolan movies as the director. The whole thing in IMAX for The Odyssey, the IMAX scenes in the other movies you saw leading up to him getting to that point for doing The Odyssey. The screenplay for The Dark Knight is by Christopher and his brother, Jonathan Nolan. And I believe David S. Goyer has a story credit as well, but not a screenplay credit. And I'm curious, you know, just in your opinion, from your approach, who's someone who's written a bunch of villains and played in that space for so long, how much you think of these performances were on the page, were in the actors' minds, or were brought out on set or through rehearsal, through direction? Like, how much of this lightning in a bottle, my words, for the dark of capturing the Dark Knight, the magic that is the Dark Knight, how much of that do you think was each piece, or do you think it was just purely, you can't recreate it, it's just pixie dust, right place, right time?
So I would imagine maybe 20% of it was on the page, you know, in carefully crafted dialogue and you know, action lines that tell like what happens in the scene, what unfolds. But I really believe that the rest is largely Heath Ledger, and with some guidance and balancing of the performance from Nolan. But I think that, you know, for writers in general, there's always this struggle of how much do you try to direct on the page versus how much restraint do you show on the page so that when it's actually brought to life on screen by the director, by the actors, by the director of photography, by the editors, like when all of the audience-facing pieces are put together, like that's where, in my mind, the majority of the magic has to happen. It has to, like, it starts on the page so that people can start to see the potential. But if you write a script and it's so prescriptive that you're saying, you know, Joker laughs maniacally and, you know,
licks his lips five times between,
exactly. you wind up stripping other creative talents of their agency. And and I think like this is probably something that I made this point before about, like, you know, in TV, so much is on the writers to, you know, to write the script. And then, you know, the rest of the piece is, setting aside the actors who obviously, you know, they are recurring, but the rest of it is kind of like a machine. I think when I moved over to games, I started to really understand that the words matter, obviously, but mostly as a way of kind of inspiring other people with, you know, creative disciplines to bring their talents to bear. So whether we're talking about actors in a VO booth or we're talking about artists who are doing concept art for characters, if I, just giving an example, if I say, hey, you know what, our villain needs to have, you know, a patch over one eye and a parrot on his shoulder and, you know, and he flies a spaceship. Well, guess what? The concept artists are going to give me exactly that, but that might not be the best version of that character. If instead I talk about like the trauma that they endured as a child and the ruthlessness that they, you know, witnessed in dealing with, you know, other pirates that, you know, that they went out with, you know, as a youth, and, you know, a theme that is, you know, they're blinded to the truth or something like that, then like that concept artist might come back to me with an amazing, you know, character that may still have a patch over its eye and it may have like that parrot on its shoulder, but it will be, you know, the best version of that possible. And I think that that's the way that I approach creativity now. I don't have all the answers. I have ideas, but those ideas just get, you know, exposed to the group and then get pressure tested and then get improved upon as the process goes on and on and on. I've got a mantra that I often talk about, which is writing is 99% rewriting. And I think that that's not just the writer doing the rewriting. That is external influences and feedback and, you know, perspective from other people coming in and helping make the story, the experience that you're trying to make better. But old Dave, like 20 years ago, I had a very different view of it. So to circle back on your initial question, you know, I think there probably was a decent amount of direction for, you know, Joker as a character on the page of that script. But the real magic happened when, you know, an actor took that and ran with with it. And the director said, and here's how I want to like balance that with these other performances. And then how, you know, editorial came in and kind of built tension by intercutting sequences, and soundtrack came in and scored things in just the right way. Like, I think all of these things came together to make magic, but it couldn't have been fully captured on the page. Otherwise, it would have been far too restricting.
I love listening to you talk, because I feel like so much of what you're saying goes back to something you said at the beginning, is that your favorite part is collaboration. And it really seems like you're hitting that theme over and over again, as the things that you kind of enjoy about things or the things that you're taking out of projects, and how they come together in a way that, you know, it might have one person's name on it, or one person playing a role, or one person as the director or the writer, but it really is this creative team of people who come together and make so much of the stuff that we love. Speaking of the creative team, here's a clip of Christopher Nolan talking about some of what it was like working with Heath as Heath created parts of the Joker.
He'd sort of give me hints about what he was going to do, and we'd talk about it a bit, and I would try and be an audience for him, or sort of gauge with him, you know, what he was doing. But a lot of it was about unpredictability, and I think he wanted to play his cards a little closer to the chest, so he would very gradually reveal to me the voice and the way, you know, he was going to do things and all the rest, but not in one go, like, oh, here's the Joker. We watched him sort of develop it with the wardrobe and the makeup and everything, and kind of, you know, I got to be a part of that creative process, which was great fun. But on set, there were always moments like that clapping or things he would do with his voice. His voice was so unpredictable. He created this bizarre pitch that I've seen a lot of people try to imitate since. But you never quite knew whether he was going to go high or whether he was going to go low. You never knew what that guy was going to do. And that was what was terrifying about it.
I don't know what, and speaking of knowing what Heath was going to do, here's a clip of Aaron Eckhart talking with Larry King about how Aaron and Heath worked through the Two-Face Joker hospital bed scene.
Like this. I'd watch him. Didn't say anything for maybe an hour. He would walk around. And then we'd watch him. And then he'd start saying his lines. And I would watch him, boom, watch him come around the bed like this. And then all of a sudden my hand would go up like this, and he caught my hand. So we just went through this organic process of developing this scene, which was really nothing. And then when we came time to shoot, we had this thing beautifully choreographed, and, you know, we never said a word to each other.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it was a long day, and we walked out back to our trailers, and Heath was here, and I was walking, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he goes, "That's what acting's all about."
Just incredible. You also mentioned the score, which is also a team of people. It's Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard, whom, I'll be honest, I wasn't aware of James Newton Howard's work until I started prepping for this episode. Pretty Woman, The Hunger Games series, The Fugitive, and his, according to the research I did, he broke into scoring on film working on part of David Lynch's Dune. Like,
really?
Not the whole film, but, you know, part of David Lynch's Dune. And listening to The Dark Knight, or watching it and then listening to specifically for the score, it doesn't jump out, in my opinion, as a Hans Zimmer piece. I think I have the idea of what Hans Zimmer is and have the idea of the type of music that he makes. And for whatever reason, maybe it's this collaboration, The Dark Knight feels almost like a horror movie to me, with the tension that the score creates, the uneasiness of, I mean, I guess it's still a melody, but it's purposely breaking rules, it feels like. And I'm curious, as you took in the film, how much of that had an impact on you in addition to what you were seeing on the screen?
So, little known fact about me, whenever I'm doing my writing, I always listen to instrumental music. Sometimes it's EDM. Sometimes it is classical music.
EDM is when you're writing fast. That's when you have a deadline. You know, you gotta crank it out.
A lot of times it is, you know, it's scores from some of my favorite movies. And The Dark Knight's one, Inception is another. Oblivion is another. And sometimes, you know, the full album will just randomly come on and, you know, as the next thing on my playlist. And whenever Dark Knight starts, it's, when you mentioned horror, it just kind of like, it reminded me of this, that opening sequence, which obviously it's like, it's not a horror sequence, but like the score goes, da-da-da. And it's, there's like this jaggedness to it that is really jarring. And it has this kind of Pavlovian effect on me. When I hear it, I automatically start getting excited. It's like, even if I'm in the middle of like writing something for a somber scene, you know, I oftentimes I'll just have the music in the background so it can kind of, you know, act as white noise. But whenever that comes on, like I can feel my heart starting to flutter a little bit. I can feel it starting to race a little bit. And I'm like, oh yeah. Okay, I know what album this is. And I kind of, you know, will just inherently stop and listen to it for a little bit just because I enjoy it that much. I don't know why, but it has that like sense memory, I guess, where I'm like, oh, I love this so much. Oh, I love this scene so much. Oh, this part is fantastic.
To dive in a little more on the score here, because I think the music is such a big part of the film, here's the man himself, Hans Zimmer, talking on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast about writing music for The Dark Knight and The Joker.
There are two ways of writing film music. You know, you can stay outside the character and, you know, you can say, oh, it's tension. You know, you're right. Sort of blanketing it, you know, with tension. He's going to come, you know, da, 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 whatever, right. You know. And mayhem's going to come. And what I was trying to do is, I was just trying to, it's like, you know, this sort of, this bow being pulled inside this guy, you know, this bow of anarchy. So I wanted the tension to always come from within him.
Right.
So the music is always inside the character as opposed to describing them from the outside.
The idea of the music being inside the character is such a fascinating way to put it. And I guess it describes why I got a horror feeling from it, because the Joker is full of that chaos and just absolute terror and horror. For me, it's all around the police station and when they have the Joker and what's happening, and it just in a good way, it's like nails on a chalkboard. It's just like, it makes me recoil in a way that brings me into the film. Sorry, just really quick to jump in on myself. It's when Batman is confronting Joker in the interrogation room. When you watch this scene in the movie theater, the subtle sound, scoring behind it, just something about it, like the bells or whatever they are quietly chiming or something. Hopefully it comes across in this quick clip too. It's not overpowering, but it's there in the background, just elevating the scene.
To them, you're just a freak. Like me. They need you right now. But when they don't, they'll cast you out. Like a leper. See, their morals, their code. It's a bad joke. Dropped at the first sign of trouble. They're only as good as the world allows them to be. I'll show you. When the chips are down, these civilized people, they'll eat each other. See, I'm not a monster. I'm just ahead of the curve.
And I think a lot of times, movies that I love go for bigger musical moments. And The Dark Knight certainly has those. But I think it also allows things to play in the silence. And I guess for me, that's kind of what makes me think of horror is like how you build that tension and then what they're going to do to pop it and how you're going to react to it as the viewer.
I love that. And now I'm going to watch it again with that in mind. No, because I think, you know, one of the things that I learned in film school, and I didn't mention this before, like in my background. So I went to film school at USC and...
Pretty good school for that, I guess.
I'll say this. I was immensely lucky to get in there. Like I wouldn't be admitted nowadays. There's no chance. But I was a bit of an albatross there because, or an outsider, because I knew that I wanted to do TV, and the majority of people at that time wanted to do, they wanted to be the next Lucas or Spielberg or Tarantino. It was very film centric, whereas I wanted to do like small screen stuff. But I'll never forget one class that we had. It was all about sound design, and we had multiple classes, multiple lectures, all about the power of silence. And this was amidst all the classes where we were talking about, you know, layering of sound and, you know, environmental, you know, sounds and score and all this other stuff and how you balance dialogue and yada, yada, yada. And then we shifted and said, but like, here's the profound impact that like the absence of sound can have on the experience. And it's something that I've carried with me, you know, throughout my career, because I think a lot of times, especially in games, there's this tendency to add more. It's like, oh, let's add more VFX. Oh, let's add more, you know, audio cues. Oh, let's add more noise. And I think that, you know, sometimes that works. Sometimes that's great. But I always will look for the moments where we can drop all that away, because I know that that's going to get people to sit up and listen a little bit more. And it's going to get them to start questioning, well, why am I now being deprived of the sounds of the world? And as creatives, like, we have to do that with intentionality. It can't just be arbitrary, right? But, you know, it can go a long way to help really set the mood and express theme, or like, you know, focus on character or, you know, immediate trauma or whatever you wanted to deliver, or horror. You know, to your point, if you're moving through an environment in a game and you hear nothing, you know, or you hear a lot of stuff and then all of a sudden it drops out and you hear nothing, you're bracing for that to be broken. You're bracing for, you know, some monster to come screaming at you out of the darkness. And, you know, then it's incumbent on the creative team to kind of subvert those expectations and make it feel, you know, unique and interesting.
Yeah, silence is golden. We've all heard that before. But really, knowing when to let something just be, it's an absolute art. Okay, quick break for sponsors, and then we'll be back with Dave and more of The Dark Knight right after this. The idea of Christian Bale's performance as it relates to Heath Ledger's. We've seen a wide variety of Batman over the years, you know, Adam West, the Kevin Conroy, the iconic voice performance of the animated series, right? The Batman of Keaton and then Clooney and Val Kilmer and now Robert Pattinson. And they all bring something different to the role.
Yeah.
And I think there's something unique about how well The Dark Knight's Joker works juxtaposed against Christian Bale's Batman. And it feels like, maybe this is just my comedy background, you know, raising a little flag for me, but it feels like being the straight man in a sketch where rarely will you win the award or get the standing ovation, but without you, there's not the setup for the glorious payoff that, you know, the comedic actor gets when they bring things into the scene. And I think there's such a fine balance and amount of restraint in what Christian Bale brought to their scenes together that really elevated the whole film without it feeling like each was competing for the spotlight.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, because he shows so much restraint and because he follows the rules and because he like kind of bottles all sorts of stuff up, when he does explode, like in that interrogation scene and he smashes Joker's head into the window, like it resonates that much more powerfully. And I think that that's, you know, it's that duality that really helps it pop. One other thing, when you first started talking about Batman's restraint or Bruce Wayne's restraint, it made me actually think about like the set design. And like, this was something that like my son, so I rewatched it recently with my son, who he'd seen it before, but we kind of like, we're just watching it again to enjoy it. And he made this point just saying, wow, like for a guy who is so wealthy, like he lives in a lot of empty spaces. And like, if you look at his his penthouse, if you look at like his underground lair, if you look at like all these things, the sparseness of the environments, you know, or the minimalist, you know, nature of the environment, I think, you know, it's clear that that is meant to be like a thematic expression of his emptiness as a person. And like, you know, he doesn't have the creature comforts of life around him. He doesn't have Rachel, like the one person that he desperately wants. Instead, he lives this life of isolation with just, you know, Alfred and Lucius, you know, as people he engages with. But like, he's almost in like self-isolation. And I think that that is like the ultimate form of restraint. So that when we see him, you know, out and about doing stuff, like he has made this conscious choice to keep things at arm's reach so he doesn't let anything get too close. And then when he's forced to get, you know, up close and personal with the Joker, we see that he has this, you know, propensity for violence too. He's got that in him, which I think actually goes and proves the Joker's point. Like, I can put people into a situation which forces them to show their true selves. And it's at that moment that he, you know, he shows what Batman's true self is. And ironic, just side note to that, you know, it was pointed out to me by somebody. So obviously, you know, he smashes Joker's head into the window and, you know, the window, the observation window like shatters or whatever. Little shards of glass fall to the ground. And it's only because that happened that Joker is actually able to escape, which blew my mind. I'm like, that sort of like cause effect relationship that is so rooted in character. It was just, it escaped me like the 15 prior times that I'd watched this. And now I can't ignore it. I can't not see. It's like, oh, and that happens everywhere in this movie. I think it's a masterclass in character development and layering, you know, action with motivation in a way that's just beautiful.
Yeah, and reinforcing them in ways that don't feel trite or redundant. Because I think I don't know if the character is it Bullock, when whoever comes in to watch him after Batman leaves, he uses the same ploy again on the character, and the character again. I think it's Bullock. I'll correct it and I'll get it in a sound up if I don't have the character right.
Where are they?
It's Stevens, Detective Stevens. I'll probably still think it's Bullock, but that's a me problem. What can you do sometimes? Anyway, Stevens. They say a way to remember a name is to say it three times. I guess we'll see about that.
Where are they?
He even calls out almost as an audience surrogate, like, I know what you're going to try to get me to do. I've watched the movie or whatever, right? I know what you're going to try to get me to do. And then he does it anyway. And the character's like, I'm still going to enjoy it, you know? And it's like, oh, you idiot.
You're walking right into his trap. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know that I know that you know that I know, and you're still doing it. Yeah. Brilliant.
Guns are too quick. You can't savor all the little emotions. You see, in their last moments, people show you who they really are. So, in a way, I knew your friends better than you ever did. Would you like to know which of them were cowards?
I know you're gonna enjoy this. I'm gonna have to try and enjoy it even more.
You mentioned at the start, looking to this character, Heath Ledger's Joker, in this film as kind of, I forget the word used, was inspiration, but a learning for the characters that you're writing or the work that you're doing now. I'd love to circle back to that. Dark Knight came out in 2008, I think. So in that almost, 20 years since then. How have you taken this work into the work that you're doing? And hopefully it's not by holding a knife to people's mouths and asking them questions about your appearance.
Haven't come to that yet. No, so I think, you know, at the core, what I took away from The Dark Knight and from, you know, Heath Ledger's Joker is this idea that, you know, conflict doesn't have to be just something physical. Like there is an emotional, a psychological aspect to that. And a lot of times in games, the enemies are meat puppets. Like, you know, if you are in a shooter, like you have wave upon wave upon wave of enemies that are coming at you. And, you know, if you have a boss battle that you go into, you have like a bullet sponge that you are trying to take down. And I think that, you know, games have gotten a lot more savvy and storytelling in games has gotten a lot more savvy over the years, but there still is this tendency to focus on how do we make the game as fun and as bombastic as possible? How do we make this a blockbuster experience? If we're dedicating a bunch of resources to putting in a boss battle, how do we make that, you know, stand out in players' minds and make it feel climactic and compelling? And a lot of times that leans on environment. Like, what does the arena look like? What are the trappings of the world? It's, you know, is combat mechanics. It's like, what does the boss or what do the enemies do that forces the player to engage different tactics? And now for me, all of that still may be true, but I always ask the question, why? Why is this boss doing this? Why are these enemies willing to like throw themselves into the line of danger, you know, for their worldview? And if we don't have a good answer, we need to find a good answer. And then even if we find a good answer, just the realities of game pacing and systems means that we have to be really selective in how we actually express those things. So like we oftentimes, even if you have like a named boss that you're going to be building up toward fighting, the moments that you are going to be spending with that boss are really few and far between. So you need to make sure that each one of those is kind of like an onion. You know, you are building an onion by putting layer upon layer upon layer, so that as the player goes through and has these moments where they are meeting this adversary, we're peeling back layers and they can start to get to the core of that, so that by the time we get to that final encounter, we understand the nuance, we understand how that boss's or that enemy's, you know, motivation is expressed in the world. But then by the time we get to that final thing, all that's left is that deeper payoff of what was like the hardest internal truth or the most core wound that they are trying to, you know, inflict pain on the world so that they don't have to reflect on that themselves. So that means looking at, you know, the cinematics that we have. It means looking at mission dialogue and the way that characters talk about the enemies. Like, we need to find ways to say, you know, I know that he just blew up this thing and here's why I think he did it. Because as we start to attribute, you know, motivations to the enemy, even if they're wrong, even if like our theories are wrong all along, the theories can evolve as long as it gets us closer and closer and closer to what that truth is. And just because, you know, we have various systems in games to kind of express that, you know, we'll want to balance it, like I was saying, across cinematics, across mission dialogue, across weapon descriptions, or, you know, Wikipedia text, or like oftentimes we'll think about it inside the game, but we'll also think about like our marketing campaign. Like, how do we start to build this relationship between the audience and the characters in this game so that they go, oh, the big bad is going to be this, and I think I understand who they are and what, like, why it's going to be fun to dismantle them. But I always come back to, like, you know, our villains need to be the heroes in their own stories. And if they are doing something because they think it's fundamentally right, then that's going to make it that much more fun to break that apart and to defeat them in the end. Or it's going to be great fun to, like, to have to think about that and go, wow, well, like, yeah, you know, I had to take him out, but he said something that was actually kind of interesting. And now, like, I'm putting down the controller, but I'm still thinking about what themes of the game were. So yeah, I think that, you know, games oftentimes lean a lot into the physical element of conflict. And I try to think, you know, about how that can be supported and supplemented by the emotional and psychological conflicts, external conflicts and internal conflicts for the characters.
I love that, thinking about that in terms of video games specifically, where I feel like if done well, no one notices. It's like a perfectly smooth flight with no turbulence. You get your drinks when you get them and you land and you don't have to wait for a baggage claim. You know, you're just in and out. It's like, that was delightful. Wow. And I feel like if you do that work and people playing the game, it's just, this feels like this is a 10 out of 10 and they maybe don't know why,
yeah.
But it's just all of those pieces, again, going back perhaps to collaboration, really just come together. As we do at the end of every show, I ask the guest to bring a quote to the show. I don't know it in advance. I feel like The Dark Knight has several quotes that people that have stuck with people, be it from The Dark Knight or something else.
So this is going to sound weird. I'm an optimistic person who tries to be uplifting any way I can. So the fact that I'm going to quote, you know, the villain of The Dark Knight is kind of ironic. But I think the quote that I've been carrying, especially recently, is "Why so serious?" And I think that the world around us is dark right now. And there are so many challenges and there are so many opportunities for people to kind of like spiral or fall into pits of despair. And I view it as my personal goal to try to help, you know, any way I can show people that there's light at the end of the tunnel. There are things that we can control in our lives. There's so much that we can't control, but there are things that we can control. And if I focus on the things that I can control, then I can actually see impact in the world. So when I talk about why so serious, like I think the people who are so serious tend to be the one to dwell on the things that they can't actually control. They focus on the things that, you know, that are, you know, political or social constructs or things that are so large and so massive that we oftentimes have to navigate through those things. But it's our interpersonal relationships, things that we talk about with one another, the impact that I can have on my kids. You know, if I can like put a little bit of optimism into that, if I can put a smile on for that, if I can, you know, make light of that, then hopefully that'll spread. And hopefully that'll, you know, inspire other people to go out and be a light for others. And I think that's all I'm trying to do in the world these days. There's plenty of other stuff to worry about. If I can just make something a little bit brighter for somebody else, just one other person, then they can kind of pass that forward. That's, you know, I've done my job.
Finding optimism in a world full of chaos. If yes. That's not a theme from The Dark Knight, I don't know what is.
Exactly.
I want to co-sign the message behind that quote so dang hard. Find the optimism. A quote I've had in my head for weeks now, and one thing I have a sticky note on the wall above my computer monitor is just, be the joy. That's it. Nothing is guaranteed to us. So yeah, find the optimism. Be the joy. Formative Media was created and is hosted by me, Christian Spicer. Thanks to Dave for joining us. You can check out Dave and Curious Wonderland at curiouswonderland.com. And okay, that's it. That's the episode. Our opening theme song was made by Tim McEwen. His band, The Midnight, is heading back out on tour. Catch them whenever and however you can. They are so good live. Our podcast album art photograph was taken by Jordan Epstein. AJ Filari is the all-star editor that makes every episode sound so good. And if you're a patron or you choose to become a patron, you not only get the ad-free episodes of this show, you get our bonus show Zeitgeist with Nicole Zavalich and Khalif Adams, but you'll also get the State of the Podcast check-in where AJ and I discuss the production realities of the show and all the other how the sausage is made goodness. Head over to patreon.com/formativemediashow to support the show and help make sure it will continue. Of course, you can always contact us at formativemediashow@gmail.com. Until next time, live the moments you'll be nostalgic for later. Thanks for listening.